I have to go upstairs and record something again, so...
Quiet.
Do not...
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
You're listening to Pandemic, a podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungine, and each week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. Sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat. The correspondents and I will be recording this in many cases on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Thursday, November 19th, and as we record this in the evening, the global COVID death toll is at 1.35 million, up over 130,000 since our last episode 2 weeks ago. Cases have risen by over 8 million in that time and now stand at 56.4 million. Here in Ireland, the death toll rose by 77 in the last 2 weeks. It now stands at 2,010. Cases rose by 5,000 in the last fortnight and now stand at 69,473. Coming up later in this episode, Liverpool's mass testing pilot programme. University of Liverpool Health and Life Sciences Pro-Chancellor Louise Kenny gives us the up-close and expert view of the hunt for asymptomatic cases in one of the UK's worst affected areas. And Austria shuts schools, imposes curfews and embarks on an antigen testing programme too. We'll talk to ORF's John Cummins in Vienna. But starting off here, progress has stalled on bringing down case numbers, say health chiefs. Let's get more detail from our science and environment correspondent, George Lee. Hiya.
Hiya.
So George, you had a busy day at the briefings today. There was a HSE briefing and the chief executive of the HSE, Paul Reid, was at that. And then you were down at the NPHET briefing this evening for the Thursday briefing as well. So progress has been made, but we're stalled. That's what we heard today.
Yes, and that kind of came as a bit of a surprise, I think, over the last day or two when people began to really look at these numbers. And you could see very clearly we were stuck around 400 cases per day, and it hadn't gone down for a good 7 days, maybe 8, and even if you add in today, certainly 7 or 8 days. And that was very unusual because we were such a stellar performer in Europe in terms of driving down those numbers from a high of 12,800 down to this level. I was falling like a stone. It was really incredible. And there was a reliance on that pace continuing. So we got to this holy grail of the 2nd of December, where we were hoping to have between 50 and 100 cases per day. And you see people over the last week from IBEC and elsewhere banging the table saying, we want the government to do it even sooner, and we want a plan in relation to how we're going to open up, and we want to know when we're going to stock all of our shops and all that stuff. But they were expecting that we'd even get there sooner. But the figures over the last couple of days suggested that there could be
right.
A question mark
over that. What is
that's
the problem?
That's what today was about.
Okay, well, in the initial lockdown, when way back in the spring, the aim was to get the R number below one. We are below one. Yeah. We're 0.7 or 0.9, and there are only two countries in Europe doing better than us, Finland, I think, and Lithuania. So what is the problem?
The problem is that we're only below one for a very short period right now, maybe 2 weeks. And it takes a long time if you're coming from a very high level of disease, which would have been 1,200, or even if it were 600, it takes a long time, then a couple of weeks, for that to work its way through. Like if it was, say, an R of half, 0.5, which would be really low and be brilliant, it still means that, you know, you start with 1,000 cases this week, you know, you pass it on to 500 next week, 250 the following week, 125 the following week. So it takes a while for those things to clear through your system. And we wanted to have them all cleared by the 2nd of December. So that meant that we had to keep on going. And the problem is that nobody quite knew until this evening how NPHET would be able to explain what happened with regard to the effort, because the R number has gone up over the past week. Last week, they were saying through their calculations that it would be 0.6. Get it down a fraction more and we're right there. And today it's back up to somewhere between 0.7 and 0.9, closer to 1. And that's not surprising when you look at the numbers. So we're going backwards.
Right.
And so all of the plans which were there, they said, what's gone wrong? And what was different about today, from NEFIT's point of view, is that they've produced an analysis which I haven't seen them produce before. I've heard them talk about stuff like this before, but never seen the picture. And it was where they had looked at what are people doing, who are you meeting? And the way they managed to do it was they were able to look back at the close contacts on average for the people who tested positive going back to the beginning of the pandemic. And they traced it right throughout the period up until now. And they find that this is a really good leading indicator of what happens with the case numbers. Every time that goes up, 10 days later, the incidence goes up. So the more people you meet, it goes up like almost in a mechanical fashion.
And it's not by much, is it, George? Because Professor Philip Nolan was saying that people had gone from an average of 2.6 contacts per positive case. It's only gone up about a half a point more than that to 3.2 contacts per positive case. And that has had the effect of stalling the progress that had been made in previous weeks.
That's it. And see, the thing is that it's such a small change. Now, it's a population average. So, you know, like.
So, who's meeting? Because it said.
Well, I imagine that you haven't met anybody extra in the last couple of weeks that you would have meeting the year before, the week before. And I can tell you I haven't either, really, that I'm aware of. So, some people are meeting a lot more people, and other people are meeting nobody more. So on average, it's gone up by 0.6.
And the place that people are meeting is the workplace, yeah. It seems, is it?
Well, there's a focus on the workplace. And what the NEFIN people were saying, and the Chief Medical Officer and the Deputy Chief Medical Officer, who's Ronan Glynn, and they focused on the workplace. And they said, look, all of the numbers are suggesting to them that there's much more traffic on the road. There are much more people out and about. There are workplace car parks, which are absolutely full. And there are canteens which are full. And they said, this isn't the way it's supposed to be. People have lost touch with the message, work from home. And they're saying, if you could work, should, a big effort needs to be made to encourage employers to live up to their responsibility in the coming weeks to make sure that their workers have the ability and facility to work at home,
right,
and to encourage them to do it. And for employees to take it on themselves too, to do everything they can, that would bring that average contact down. But it isn't just them, they were saying.
No, because it doesn't explain the older people, the over 65s, aren't by and large in the workplace, and yet it's not going down amongst them. In fact, it's
it's different with the over 65s. Yeah, it's different with the over 65, particularly over 85 now, Colin, who's the over 85. And they're saying that a lot of them might be in nursing homes and facilities like that. And once the disease is running around in the community, it's very hard to protect those areas. So it takes a while to bring it down. And also because the population numbers in that age group are quite low, you know, a couple of outbreaks in a nursing home could drive that up. So they were watching it, they're careful about it, but you wouldn't make the same comparison about that. There's a separate reason for that specific incident. But when you stand back and you look at the population as a whole, you're saying, hey, look, this isn't in rocket science. We said before, and I remember Ronan Glynn making a big issue about this when he was chairing these meetings for a couple of months. It's very simple. If you have your contacts, you will have the reproduction number. But when they produced this analysis, which showed this track of the two going back to some period in the beginning of the pandemic, it was very striking. A picture painting 1,000 words. That's what was different today.
Right.
And also focusing on the employers, the workplace. More could be done. We have 2 weeks to go, and the message is we need to do more.
And younger people still doing well, because I think the last time we spoke, and it's been 2 weeks since we last spoke, younger people still doing well, still decreasing amongst younger people.
Yeah, very good on all of that. They've come down from something of the order of 450 cases per 100,000. That's about 445 cases. This is the age 19 to 24, and they're down to about 92 now, or 91, 92. So it's a very, very significant drop. They're down to about 20% of where they were back then. So I think that's a big progress has been made. But in all age groups over the recent weeks, there has been a reduction in the incidents. So I think on that front, they're not unhappy with that, but it's just a small little tweak in terms of people's efforts on average. Now, that's going to be hard for the people who have been relenting and meeting more people. It's not easy to change the behaviour. One of the issues came up about anticipatory behaviour. This is the idea that the public has been ahead of NEFIT all along in terms of the advice. They've been reducing their contacts before level 5 came in, that kind of thing. And so that the drop in the number of cases has been significantly quicker than they thought ahead of them. And again, they're wondering, there's a question about whether or not the good news in recent weeks, the news about the vaccine, the news about the fact that we were getting ahead of ourselves and we were going to make it, did that cause people to relax a little bit, anticipating that things were getting so much better, less fearful? So they're all in the mix. But regardless of what caused it, the reality is that people are meeting slightly more people than they were before. And that slightly is the key.
Right. Final question then, George. In the two subsequent interviews in this episode, we're going to touch on the issue of antigen testing. We're looking in detail at Liverpool. We'll also touch on it when we're speaking to John Cummins from Vienna as well. The questions have been asked here about whether or not mass antigen testing would be rolled out in order to find asymptomatic people. NPHET don't seem convinced. What reason have they given?
Well, I think their concern is hanging your strategy on testing, which their scientific analysis suggests is flawed and produces quite a few false readings, that they're not as happy with that. Really, at the end of the day, it is about, it's like a population approach to medicine. They want the population to change what they're doing. Whether you have a test or not doesn't change anything. If you just reduce your contacts is the answer. So why would you blow the whole message by saying, here, you can have this test that we don't really believe in and meet whoever you want? So I'm assuming that that's one of the issues. But today, at the HSE briefing, Paul Reid made the point that they have just issued a tender for antigen testing, and they say they had received 30 offers from various companies to supply antigen tests in recent weeks, and so they have decided finally to open a tender to see who's going to supply, and they will decide over the coming weeks how they will use them and in what circumstances they'd use them. But it's coming. Something is coming, but we don't know exactly to what extent. But the HSE is opening a tender, and they're looking for they're going to accept the kind of offers of one or two of those people, depending on what the supply is going to be. So I think you'll see it.
All right. Thanks, George.
Good stuff. Thanks.
Cheers. All right. Now, in a moment, we're going to have a look at how Austria is faring under a very strict lockdown. But first to Liverpool. The UK's case numbers continue to rise by around 20,000 daily, and radical action is needed to stop the spread. On Merseyside, a mass antigen testing programme is being rolled out to track down asymptomatic carriers and to take them out of circulation. If it works, it could lead to similar schemes elsewhere. Professor Louise Kenny is the Executive Pro Vice Chancellor of the Faculty of Health and Life Sciences at the University of Liverpool, so she's ideally positioned to give me an up-close expert view of the plan. I called her earlier today and got into the detail.
Hello.
Hi, is this Professor Kenny?
Yeah, speaking.
Hey, how are you doing? It's Colm O'Mungon here. How are you?
Hi, fine, thanks.
Good. Listen, thanks a million for agreeing to do this. So, Professor Kenny, why Liverpool? Why did this happen in Liverpool particularly?
As your listeners probably are aware, Liverpool had a very difficult second wave. And to be frank, we had a very difficult first wave of the pandemic as well. And in fact, as we came out of the first wave, community transmission of COVID in Liverpool never really fully dropped down to the very low levels that we saw elsewhere in the country during the summer. So it was no surprise at all, certainly to people in Liverpool, that when the second wave hit, it hit early and it hit hard. And at one point, not that long ago, certainly in late October, early November, we had a huge number of our citizens with COVID. The case rate, the number per 100,000, was persistently above 500 cases per 100,000 for several weeks. And in some parts of the city, it was close to 700 per 100,000. So one of the highest rates of COVID transmission.
And how did that look
in
hospitals in Liverpool?
Because awful. Yeah, really awful. So Liverpool, again, your listeners will be aware, Liverpool's a wonderful city and has many, many attributes, but it is a city characterised by significant health inequality and poor health outcomes anyway, even outside of, you know, a public health crisis like a pandemic. And so our hospitals are challenged during most winters. During the first wave, we were heavily hit. And during the second wave, again, you've probably seen the footage on the BBC. I think it went around the world, footage from inside the Liverpool University Hospital, from the ICU and from the COVID wards. We had a huge number of admissions, the highest number of admissions in the country, bar none, were in Liverpool during the second wave. that's just the tip of the iceberg, because obviously patients are admitted to hospital when they're really very sick. But we had an enormous number of people contracting this in the community, which I think is a worry. Now we are beginning to understand the impact of long COVID, this syndrome of prolonged symptoms and adverse health following an episode of COVID. And then there's the sort of hidden morbidity and mortality. So patients who don't present to hospital for acute care when they need it, the impact of having to cut down or in some cases stop elective service delivery in the health service, that all has a very difficult to quantify effect on the health of our population. So it's been tough.
So you mentioned the inequality of health outcomes. Is that because there are high poverty rates and low ICU provision at the same time in Liverpool, or are the hospital facilities pretty well provided for, but there is just significant social disadvantage in Liverpool? Which is it, both or one?
It's predominantly social disadvantage in Liverpool. So this is well documented. In fact, my university has done most of the pioneering public health work describing this inequality. But as you travel across the Merseyrail network, which is a bit like the Lewis or the Dart, it goes from one end of Liverpool to the other, you can travel through almost neighbouring postcodes that have such a stark difference in life expectancy. It's one of the highest differences in the country. And you know, the soundbite that we often use is that a baby girl born today in Kensington and Liverpool will live on average 12 fewer years than a baby girl born in Kensington, London. There is a very, very stark difference in health outcomes, and it's predominantly socioeconomically driven. Our hospital system, you know, it's in a state of flux at the moment. Our big two acute trusts have been through a large merger. And again, listeners may be familiar with the story of the new hospital build, which was a victim of the collapse of Carillion a few years ago. So that new hospital hasn't yet been handed over to the NHS. So we do have a slightly older infrastructure. But in general, most of those poor outcomes were driven predominantly by the socioeconomic divide.
Right. So we have that socioeconomic divide. We have a hospital system in a state of flux, as you say. And by October, I think case rates were up to about 700 per 100,000 in Liverpool. So what kind of... this pilot testing was decided to pilot it in Liverpool because Liverpool had been so badly affected by this. What kind of testing is it first, and how effective is that testing?
So we were offered the opportunity to use some of the lateral flow capacity that the UK government had purchased, and in partnership with the Department of Health and Social Care and our local Director of Public Health, we decided to take up that offer and embark upon what's been commonly called a mass asymptomatic serial testing program. It's been, I think it's fair to say, it's been mistaken in the lay press and by some academics, possibly willfully mistaken, as being a screening program. It's not actually a screening program, because people who participate in mass asymptomatic serial testing tend not to do it for their own benefit. They're doing it because it helps break the chain of infection. It's really about developing a dynamically targeted testing program, and then to break the chain of infection, and then to develop smart test to release enable protocols. So on that basis, a multi-stakeholder partnership from across the city enthusiastically embraced the opportunity to roll this programme out. And we've had fantastic support from the British military, who came to town at short notice. We've had 2,000 wonderful troops who've helped set up the mobile testing units and the asymptomatic serial testing units across the city. We've now performed, as of this morning, over 130,000 tests. And the population that we're seeking to test is about 500,000. So we're well over 20% of the way through that, and we have plans to continue.
That's quite an impressive number of people who've been tested. And as you say, this asymptomatic testing is basically you're testing as many people as possible. Where you find people who have tested positive and who are asymptomatic, they will go home and self-isolate. And in areas then, is it that where there is a high prevalence of COVID-19, people are maybe retested to ensure that false negatives, which may have gone through the first time, those false negatives are found, and those people also isolate?
We're actually offering serial testing. So we're encouraging everyone to come back after 5 days, a minimum of 5 days, to have a second test, regardless. Yeah, absolutely. Because you're right, the efficacy of the test, of the programme as a whole, improves the more people we test and the more frequently we test. So at the moment, we're offering the opportunity to come back every 5 days. And we are developing, because we're learning all the time, this is a pilot and we're learning all the time, we are learning that in corners of the city where the prevalence is highest, it's often more difficult to actually penetrate with the test. So in those areas that are marked by socioeconomic deprivation, take-up of the test is lower than we would like. And now we're pivoting to actually put in, you know, an array of procedures that will help reach those corners of our population and facilitate testing for the citizens that live there.
How do you mean? Are you offering incentives for people to come and test, for example?
No, we're just trying to make it easier. So as is often the case when you offer a public health intervention like this, take-up is very high in areas populated by the upper sort of socio-demographic descriptors. So we're trying to make it easier for those people who don't live in those areas, who live in areas of high transmission, to access testing by putting a higher number of testing units in place. We are putting in a specific targeted communication plans around those parts of the community. And we're also targeting very particular sort of sectors of the population, for example, the care home sector, the higher education sector, where we know we've had previous high levels of community transmission. We're putting in special communications and targeting those areas of the community.
Now, on a previous episode of the podcast, we were looking at Slovakia, and it being a Central European country, they closed their borders. They demanded a PCR, clean PCR test for anybody coming into Slovakia for a period of time. They then tested two-thirds of the population. They got the positive test to isolate, and they were hoping to drive down the numbers. And I think at the moment Austria is following suit, and we'll be talking about that later in this episode. But Liverpool is a busy trading port city in a busy area of the UK. So when you're testing people in Liverpool, what's been done about limiting movement within or from outside Liverpool to ensure that sources of infection aren't being reintroduced to areas? Or is that what serial testing is designed to capture?
One of the targets of serial testing is to decrease community transmission by making those people who are asymptomatic and yet still capable of passing the virus on aware of their status and encouraging them to self-isolate. It's really difficult. You know, I've spent a long time thinking about, you know, what would we do? What would I do differently if I was making some of the public health decisions back at the start of this pandemic? You know, and we look at countries like New Zealand, who've pursued a zero COVID plan, and they're to be commended for that. They've had a fantastic result. But they do have some very specific advantages countries in mainland Europe don't have: their geographical isolation, their island status, their small population, and the ease with which they could close their borders. We don't have those options in the UK. Closing the borders would have, you know, I'm sure, enormous ramifications in terms of our ability to trade, and all our economies in Europe have taken a huge hit because of this pandemic. So there are no easy decisions. And I think, you know, we certainly will and absolutely should learn the lessons of this pandemic, because as sure as night follows day, there'll be another one. It would be good to make sure that we go into the next pandemic fully armed and fully aware with the lessons learned from this one. But we are where we are right now, and I don't think there are any easy decisions. So a lot of how we've discussed MAST with our number one stakeholders in this, and they're the citizens of Liverpool, is that it's about empowering them. You know, Liverpool has had one of the hardest pandemics. It's a city that was just getting back on its feet economically, and it's taken an enormous hit. Some of my colleagues in local government think it'll take a decade to recover from what's happened to the city. And so our offer to the citizens of Liverpool is work with us. This is a program that only works if you take part in it, but together we can break the chain of infection and hopefully move out of COVID restrictions, you know, sooner rather than later. Pleasingly, I think that message has landed very well with our local citizens.
Right. One of the things that I was reading recently is that secondary school students have been offered this testing. Here in Ireland, schools have been regarded as low risk, and clusters within schools have been attributed, I suppose, to community transmission coming into schools rather than schools being locations where clusters have arisen in and of themselves and caused community transmission. Why, do you know, was there a particular focus, or at least an inclusion of secondary schools in this programme?
I think the evidence base for clusters in schools is contested. And, you know, I'm very aware that in Ireland there is, you know, there's been significant debate on this issue with, you know, two schools of thought. One is that, you know, schools are hotbeds of transmission, and other proponents saying there's no evidence for that. And the reality is there's very little evidence full stop one way or the other. So we did include secondary schools in our city in the original MAST pilot to help add some robust and hopefully statistically well-powered evidence to inform this debate. I'm actually Provost Chancellor of the University of Liverpool, and what the university brings to this is the academic firepower to perform an independent evaluation of this programme. And that evaluation is underway, so we hope to be able to offer the world, as it were, some more real-world evidence as to the facts of this in the near future.
Now, as you said, there was debate about it, and you mentioned some academics. I think Professor Alison Pollock, I saw her quoted in The Guardian, she's a professor of public health at Newcastle University, said testing should have been targeted for symptomatic people. And I think so. Another academic from Bristol saying that there should have been an evaluation before this was rolled out. You're saying that there's a kind of a misunderstanding as to what the aim and the scope of this was. What do you say to people who have raised those concerns or criticisms?
Firstly, the test was fully evaluated, and that evaluation has now been published in full, the performance of that test. It's better than I think many of the detractors had speculated in advance. It's not perfect, and quite frankly, no test that we have for COVID-19 is 100% accurate or perfect. But it is another tool in the toolbox that will help us combat this awful virus. I am aware of what Professor Pollock and a minority of academic colleagues have said about the Liverpool pilots, and what I would counter back is that the basis of their argument is that we're conducting a mass screening programme. And, you know, as I said at the top of the programme, this isn't screening. This is a public health intervention. It's serial testing. Targeted serial testing that's being informed by the pilot to help break the chain of transmission. The basis of a screening program is that someone takes part in screening because it's of personal benefit to them. You know, you screen for a disease in its undetectable stages, and then there's an intervention that you can do that will ameliorate the effect of that disease. And the sort of hallmark, the framework of screening has been well developed over the last 5 or 6 decades. And it's one of the four cornerstones of good public health. But this isn't screening, and it's disingenuous to pretend that it is. If you take part in an asymptomatic testing program, you're doing it not for yourself, but you're doing it to protect your fellow citizens. You know, I take part in asymptomatic testing, not because it's of any immediate benefit to myself. If anything, all that will happen is that I'll be told to go home and self-isolate, which would be, frankly, slightly distressing. But I do it because I don't want to pass on the virus to my vulnerable elderly mother or my elderly aunt or anyone else in my social bubble, because, you know, that would be irresponsible. When there is a test available that will help reduce the chance of that happening, then I think it would be, from a public health perspective, it would be excellent public health to take part. Now, having said all that, we're only now 10 months into a pandemic. This time last year, we hadn't heard of COVID-19, and we're learning all the time. And absolutely, we will make mistakes, and we may not get it right. But Liverpool was offered the opportunity to do something that we thought would add knowledge to the area. We will fully and independently evaluate the pilot. And then I think we could take a step back and look at the effectiveness, the efficacy of the pilot. I think Alison Pollock and her colleagues have also conflated some of their concerns around this being screening, which I hopefully have dealt with the economic arguments. And I'm not a health economist, and I'm not going to engage in that. The UK government had already purchased the units. So, it's not my place to argue about the health economic benefit of this. The economic decision to purchase the test had already been made. We were offered the chance to use it and evaluate it. And I think it was a perfectly reasonable decision to do so.
Now, I suppose, as the old expression in Cork goes, nice to see a Cork man doing well in Dublin. To paraphrase that, you are familiar. Nice to see a Cork woman doing well in Liverpool, because you are familiar with University College Cork, where you worked for quite some time in the area of obstetrics, I think, was it? And this is being debated in Ireland at the moment with the National Public Health Emergency Team. Here, they don't seem convinced of the merits of it. Now, obviously, you'll evaluate your own programme, but you seem to have embraced this enthusiastically. Would you recommend it? Would you even go so far as to say, what harm? Try it.
No, I don't think I would be that gung-ho. I think we were offered a very specific opportunity in Liverpool. The tests were already purchased. They were available. They were offered to us in a partnership framework whereby we said that we would perform a full and independent evaluation. and share the lessons learned. I think that's a very different proposal to making a decision, for example, to purchase these nationwide, this capacity nationwide for a country. I think, you know, we are moving at an absolutely breathtaking speed in terms of scientific discovery at the moment. And the evidence base around COVID is growing on a daily basis. I would hope that the Liverpool pilots will add to that evidence base in the very near future. And then other regions, other governments will have additional information upon which to make rational decisions around the risk-benefit ratio of, for example, asymptomatic testing with this particular technology. This technology has advantages. So again, your listeners may be aware that we did have issues with test and trace in the UK, particularly slow turnaround times, accessing PCR testing and slow turnaround times. And that means that if you are symptomatic and you have a PCR test, in some parts of the country, it was 4 days before you got the result. Now, that's potentially 4 days in which someone who may have mild symptoms could continue to go about their daily business, not now in lockdown, but previously. And in fact, you know, huge numbers of people in the community. The advantage of these lateral flow tests is the answer is almost instantaneous. You get an answer within about 20 to 60 minutes. And that means that you know there and then whether you are positive or not, albeit with some risk of false negatives and false positives.
Right.
And I don't think we should underestimate how important that is, particularly in areas of the country where transmission is high, and particularly in sectors of the community where transmission is high and where the risk of transmission is high. I think the risk-benefit ratio of all of these technologies falls one direction or another as community transmission falls. But, you know, when we took this decision, we were at the peak of wave two. Our city was significantly challenged. Our healthcare system was significantly challenged. And we were looking down the barrel of a long recovery period. So hopefully, as I say, we will provide an evidence base to support the use of lateral flow as one of many public health measures that can help deal with this pandemic. But we've committed to do a full and independent evaluation, and that's what we're going to do. And hopefully we'll have those results soon.
And of course, PCR testing is continuing at the same time. It's even been kind of ramped up at the same time as well.
So. It has, because we found that when we actually rolled out the asymptomatic testing, we found that the publicity actually attracted an increased number of citizens who actually had symptoms. So we found that the numbers of people accessing symptomatic testing with PCR has also increased. And that, again, is an unanticipated but particularly beneficial side effect of this programme, that we've managed to actually identify those who have symptoms.
Okay, Professor Louise Kenny, we'll see how your evaluation obviously goes, and it will remain to see, and if you pardon the pun, whether Liverpool walks alone on this particular initiative or not. But look, thanks very much for spending the time with us, and the very best of luck with the programme.
Thanks very much.
Back in the spring, at the start of the pandemic, Austria was one of the first European countries to impose travel restrictions and introduce compulsory mask wearing. By mid-April, they had daily case numbers down in double figures, and things stayed that way until early August, when they began to creep up again. By early October, cases were at around 1,000 a day. Yesterday, cases recorded were over 7,000. Hospitals in Austria are under serious pressure, and now schools are closed and a curfew is in place. John Cummins of broadcaster ORF has been giving me the view from that curfew in Vienna. So, John, how are you?
I'm doing fine at the moment. We are in lockdown here at the moment in Vienna, in Austria. I'm working partly from home. My wife is working from home. My young daughter is home from kindergarten at the moment. So we have to juggle all of those kinds of things. But I have to say, we're kind of fairly well oiled with all this now. We've been through it all once before, so we kind of know what we're doing, and we seem to be on top of it at the moment, at least.
Well, why don't we start there? Let's go back to the spring. Austria was pretty proactive, enforced mask wearing very early, travel restrictions very early, and it got it on the floor. But its trajectory seems to have followed like Israel. They went in hard first and then lifted quite early.
That's right. It does seem to be very similar to Israel, and also perhaps to our neighbour, the Czech Republic as well, where a similar thing also occurred. I mean, you could argue perhaps there was a sense of complacency in those countries, including Austria, you know, that we did very well in that first wave of the virus and we brought it under control very quickly. And perhaps the government and people here just felt, well, you know, we've got this thing beaten, we've got it under control, and took their eye off the situation a little bit, and perhaps that's why it's come back with such a vengeance during the second wave.
So it bumped along the ground in double figures over the course of, from about April into early August. So from your observations, you're in a busy tourist spot. Vienna attracts a lot of visitors generally. Were there a lot of tourists in the country? Was it Austrians out for drinks? Where do the experts think that the particular points of contact were that caused the virus to spread?
Right, I think there are a couple of things that you can certainly point to. One was not so much tourists coming to Austria. There were very few tourists from what I saw, particularly around Vienna over the summer. But a lot of Austrians traveled abroad for their holidays as soon as the border restrictions were lifted. A lot of Austrians like to go to Croatia, for example, for their summer holidays. A lot of people have family connections in the Balkans. And those Balkan countries, unfortunately, didn't have the virus really under control over the summer like we did here and in Western Europe. And so they brought back the virus to Austria. And I have to say, the government also didn't really have a good system in place to deal with that. There wasn't sort of compulsory quarantine and testing until perhaps it was far too late. So that was certainly one reason. I think the other thing that got perhaps let go a little bit too long was it was clear over the summer that young people were becoming the drivers of the coronavirus infections in Austria. And the government didn't do a lot about that. There were bars were still open and nightclubs were still open. Of course, you know, the famous Corona parties were being celebrated. And so I think perhaps more could have been done during that period to clamp down on those kinds of things. And perhaps we wouldn't have been in the situation that we're in now if that had happened.
So at the moment in Austria, hospitals are said to be under pressure. I think I read somewhere that 83% of the coronavirus capacity units in a Tyrolean hospital were occupied. What's the kind of public concern being expressed about that? Was it the pressure on hospitals in particular that triggered the scale of the lockdown you're in at the moment?
Absolutely. In fact, to put this in another kind of way, the government actually backed itself into a bit of a corner here. In the legislation that they'd passed earlier in the year, they had more or less set themselves the condition that there would have to be a situation where hospitals were at capacity, where there was a situation where they might no longer be able to cope before they could call a second lockdown. So the government wasn't able to do that until the hospital capacity had been reached. That, of course, is a huge concern for everybody here. Once we got to the point where the doctors were saying, now, look, we don't have that many intensive care beds left and, you know, the hospital numbers are rising rapidly, then I think people felt there was definitely a need to act and to act swiftly. Now, what the government did first was to try and introduce a partial lockdown around 3 weeks ago, appealing to people to, you know, be responsible, to cut down the number of contacts, and they closed restaurants and a few things were shut. But that didn't appear to have any great impact on the level of new infection rate. So what they had to do then on Tuesday of this week was start a full-on lockdown as we experienced back in the spring when the first wave of the virus struck Europe.
And when you say full-on lockdown, you know, as you said, you're at home, your wife is working from home, you're at home most of the week, your child is home from kindergarten, but they've closed the schools, which for the Irish listener is the very last step that this government will probably entertain. Keeping the schools open means keeping the economy open. It's regarded as a drastic move. Is it regarded the same way in Austria, or is it just seen as part of the package?
No, absolutely. It was a very controversial move here too. There was a lot of discussion about this in the run-up to the announcement of the lockdown. And the education ministry here had been saying for some time that closing schools and kindergartens was an absolute last resort. And so I think people were quite surprised when that was announced then last weekend that the schools and the kindergartens were closing. What I can say, though, is that there's, of course, still some basic childminding going on at kindergartens and schools. Parents who simply can't stay at home and look after their children, particularly for people who are in, you know, important jobs like doctors and so on, who are absolutely needed on the front line of this. And back in March and April, the number of children that was attending the schools under these conditions was only, I think, around 5% of the total number, whereas now in some of the states of Austria, it's around 25%. So a lot of people are still sending their children to school or to kindergarten regardless, because they simply have to. They haven't had time to make other arrangements. Their employers won't give them the kind of flexibility they need to stay at home and look after their children. But that's been a hugely controversial step that the government's taken here.
I just want to have a look at testing with you, John, because the number of cases in Austria, so Austria has a population of between 8 and 9 million, and there have been 2,100 deaths in Austria so far. So the death toll is about the same as Ireland's, which is half the population of Austria. Ireland has had over 60,000 cases. Austria has had 228,000 cases of coronavirus. So is it that it's more out of control, or are they finding more asymptomatic people? What way, for the death toll that they've recorded, they seem to have a huge amount of cases by comparison to what we're seeing here?
Yes, fortunately, the death toll, you know, as a percentage of the number of confirmed infections is still reasonably low here in Austria. Of course, there's a lot more testing going on. They're doing now 40,000 tests a day, whereas even just a couple of months ago, they were struggling to do 15,000 tests a day. So, of course, they're catching a lot of people now who are asymptomatic, who have a very, you know, very little reaction to the coronavirus. Austria was also very successful, at least for a long time, in isolating vulnerable groups. So, for example, the elderly, people who were at risk, they took steps very early on to isolate those people, to get them out of the workforce, to put systems in place to protect them. Unfortunately, just today, we've had the news come in that I think half of the deaths that have occurred in aged care homes and care homes in Austria have occurred in the last 40 days. So that situation is certainly very worrying. A lot of people who work, the staff, the personnel who work in those homes are now testing positive. If that trend continues, then of course the number of deaths in Austria could also rise significantly. So that's something the government certainly is trying to get on top of and they're very aware of, but that's a very worrying trend at the moment.
Final couple of questions then. Antigen testing. We were speaking earlier in this episode to Professor Louise Kenny from Liverpool, who was talking about the rollout of the antigen testing program in Liverpool. Antigen testing, Austria is taking its cue perhaps from Slovakia, the neighbouring country which closed its borders, introduced antigen testing to try and trace people who are asymptomatic and get them to isolate and get them out of circulation. How's that been going? What's the sign-up been like?
Well, there at the moment, the government's discussing trying to do something similar to what Slovakia has done, in that they want to test basically everybody that will be tested. It's not going to be compulsory testing, but on a voluntary basis, to try and ease this lockdown as quickly as possible. So they want to test really the entire population, if possible, before Christmas. That's all very vague. It's in the very early stages at the moment, and the specifics of how that will work are not clear, what kind of testing they will use, how they will test people, and so on. The antigen tests are a little controversial here. They're available also privately from chemists and so on. And I know that the Doctors Association here has sort of warn people against using those tests, saying they're unreliable. If you don't use them correctly, they can give you a false result. Of course, they're also, the results aren't collected in the national data either. So that's also another problem for the people trying to track the disease and find out where the hotspots are and what exactly is happening. So I think the door's still a little bit open on the antigen tests. Don't seem to be entirely convinced that that's the way to go. But of course, the PCR testing is so much more complicated, and that's something that requires a lot of expertise and requires a lot of manpower as well.
Now, the Chancellor finally then, Sebastian Kurz, has had quite a bit of good fortune in his time as a politician. He's less fortunate this time around in the pandemic because his opposite number, the leader of the opposition, the SPÖ party, is herself a doctor, which lends credibility to her criticism of the government's handling of the pandemic, does it?
Indeed. I mean, you would think that she would be absolutely front and centre in this whole crisis. In fact, she's been a little bit anonymous, I have to say, in the whole thing. Mr. Kurz is very good at controlling the message, at being out front, at taking the credit when the credit is right there to be taken. I have to say, there's been some criticism, of course, of the government in more recent times for their handling of the pandemic. But we haven't seen that really so much in terms of a spillover into people withdrawing their support from the government. You know, there haven't been sort of sackings of ministers or anything like that. And also recently we had elections here in Vienna, council elections, and actually the two parties that are in power nationally, the Conservatives, the People's Party and the Greens, both increased their share of the vote in those elections. So, you know, it would seem that people are reasonably happy with the course that's being taken. They seem to be reasonably happy with Mr. Kurz's leadership. One caveat, though, that I will say is that there have been surveys done about the level of happiness with the government's handling of this coronavirus crisis. Now, at the beginning of the crisis, back in February and March, the government was enjoying, you know, really amazing, huge popularity, incredible support. People were really backing the government's handling of this. However, now, when you look at the polling, it's only around sort of 50-60% of people who say, well, the government's doing a good job, they're handling this well. So the criticism is growing louder. However, the opposition doesn't seem to be able to capitalize on that discontent at the moment. But perhaps, you know, as this thing goes on, that will change in the near future.
All right. John, thanks very much for talking to us. Stay safe. I can't say enjoy the curfew, but survive it anyway.
Gee, thanks, John.
And that's all for this episode of Pandemic. We're back next week with more. In the meantime, do get in contact with suggestions or questions by email to colm.omongain@rte.ie. That's colm.omongain@rte.ie. Or you can contact me on Twitter @colmomongain. Do subscribe through your usual podcast platform to get this podcast regularly. Reviews are welcome. Nice reviews are even more welcome. Thanks for listening.